Hello and welcome to the American Society of Regional Anesthesia and Pain podcast as a wrap. I'm your host, Raj Gupta, coming to you from Nashville, Tennessee. And I've got a wonderful group of people here to talk with me today. These are representatives of the LGBTQIA plus special interest group within the American Society of Regional Anesthesia and Pain Medicine. And I think we have a really interesting topic to discuss today. And I'm going to introduce all the folks that are going to be joining me in a moment, but I do want to remind everybody that the American Society of Regional Anesthesia Pain Medicine is having their fall meeting coming up very soon. And let me put this up here for you guys to see. This is our 22nd annual pain medicine meeting. This is focused around chronic pain, transitional pain, and even some things for acute pain physicians as well, because there's a lot of crossover these days. It is in New Orleans, which is a fantastic city, especially in November. It's a beautiful time to be there, November 10th through the 11th. If you haven't already registered, I don't know what you're doing. Make sure you go register, join the meeting. There's so much good content for this meeting. And get your space at the hotel as well. Those sell out really quickly. So make sure you go to the website, azra.com/pain, and you can see all the details about the meeting coming up in November, November 10th through the 11th. I'll be there. Make sure you come up to me and say hi. I love talking to new people and getting to know them, getting to know what their interests are, and hopefully finding a place for them within the organization and giving them a chance to really expand on their interests. So in the very near future, I'll see you in New Orleans, and I want to make sure everybody has a chance to register for that meeting. So let's get back to our topic for today, and I want to introduce my guests. So bear with me. They have wonderful CVs, and I get to share with you just a short paragraph of all the amazing work that they do, but I think you'll be impressed. So first, I have Kiki Nin. She's an associate professor of anesthesiology and assistant chair of clinical services at the University of Florida and medical director of the Florida Surgical Center and the Oaks. She's a fellowship trained in acute pain and perioperative pain medicine at University of Florida Health. Dr. Nin is from San Juan, Puerto Rico, and completed her medical degree in Sidney Kimmel Medical College at Thomas Jefferson University in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. Her anesthesia residency and fellowship, she completed at University of Florida in Gainesville. And some of her medical interests are nerve microanatomy, opioid-free surgery, and enhanced recovery after anesthesia. Kiki, welcome. Nice to see you. Glad to have you here.
Thank you very much.
Next up, we have Paul Su. Dr. Su is an assistant professor at the University of California, San Francisco Health in San Francisco, California. He earned his medical degree at Columbia University. Is it Vallejos College of Physicians and Surgeons? I don't know if that's a Spanish name. I may not have said that correct.
Vallejos. That's actually a new
Vallejos.
Name.
Vallejos College. Okay. And he completed his residency in anesthesiology and a fellowship in pain medicine at UCSF. His interests are in mechanisms underlying the transition between acute and chronic pain. Welcome, Paul.
Thank you. Excited to be here.
And then last, definitely not least, is Dr. Adam Fischler. He's an anesthesiologist with Integrated Anesthesia Associates in Hartford, Connecticut. He's also an assistant clinical professor and medical director of the operating room at UConn Health in Farmington, Connecticut. He earned his medical degree at the University of Maryland in Baltimore and completed both an anesthesiology residency and pain management fellowship at Emory University in Atlanta, Georgia. Special interests for him include regional anesthesia and sustainability in the operating room. Adam, welcome. Good to have you here.
My pleasure.
Well, this esteemed panel, we kind of got together today because we want to talk about a topic I think is very hot right now, topical, politically charged in some situations, but very, very sensitive and important to a large group of patients. And unfortunately, the conversation is often confusing and laced with some prejudices and biases. And I want to see if we can have an open conversation about transgender patients and patients having surgery surrounding transgender care, either related to their transition or sometimes even unrelated to their transition. I think both parts of that are really important as we care for these patients. But before we get started, Kiki, I want you to briefly talk about some of the work that the LGBTQIA plus special interest group has been doing this year within AZRA. And just so people know, if you're a member of AZRA, anybody's welcome to join the special interest group and contribute to the conversation. Kiki, you want to talk about it a little bit?
Absolutely. Thank you very much for having us. You know, it's been a very exciting year. I've been very privileged to be able to be in this SIG with Paul and Adam and the rest of the group and be able to, you know, increase visibility and talk about very important topics that are dear to our hearts that I think are very valuable to the anesthesiologists and especially our regional anesthesiologists as well in our society. So we started this endeavor, last year, and our goal is to, you know, maintain a safe and inclusive environment, not only for our patients, but also for physicians and for our staff. So we started our journey, and we wrote a ASTRA, website article with Martha regarding Marsha Johnson. Regarding transgender under Transgender Day and visibility, and I was lucky enough to be able to do an Instagram takeover and learn a little bit more about Instagram when I was in our RAPM back in April back here in Florida where I'm at, and all of our group is have worked really hard to build a chapter that will hopefully be published, early next year on perioperative pain management and transgender surgery and how we can help our patients. So very excited to continue on our journey and, increase visibility of our group and anybody who is, wants to volunteer, please go to the website, come join us. We're very excited about our next year.
Thank you, Kiki. As I know, with most special interest groups, it's not just one topic you guys are working on. There's multiple streams of work being done. And fortunately, the great thing about the special interest groups is purely voluntary. So there's no permission you need to have to join the group or to offer to help and contribute, write something. Lots of opportunities for people. People are always asking me, how do I get involved? Well, these are an easy way to get involved. And I know you guys are always looking for enthusiastic people to contribute as well. So, go up and say hi to these folks at the various meetings, go reach out to them online. I'm sure they'd be more than happy to help you find a way to contribute. Adam, I think it's probably a great place to introduce your topic. I think you wanted to talk about a personal experience and then lead that into the conversation about transgender patient care.
Well, thanks, Raj. Yeah, I do have unique perspective, being the father of a transgender daughter, which all started about four or five years ago, and also being an anesthesiologist. Through the course of going through this process with my transgender daughter, going to, PFLAG, support groups, and then now learning from the LGBTQIA plus special interest group, I feel like I've gained quite a bit from the experience. Basically, long story short, my daughter, transgender daughter, came out, as they say, the end of her freshman year of college. It was very well accepted by us as her parents, and that helped her proceed through her journey. She, started out presenting male for the summer, the early summer, while she sought mental health and medical intervention, specifically transgender endocrinologist, and then proceeded later toward the summer to engage in additional therapy and start the gender-affirming hormone therapy and proceeded with these social changes, dress, that type of thing. Through the course of time, she eventually did research, having sex reassignment surgery, and that process probably took a year and a half, in preparation. She sought out what she thought was the best program, we proceeded that way. There was a lot to do during that time. I'm not sure how much detail to go into, but I was able to see the actual surgery through both her eyes and as an anesthesiologist, and essentially developed ideas of best course of action in preparation for surgery, preoperative, intraoperative, and that type of thing.
I think in the lay public, there's a lot of conversation about how, quote unquote, easy it is to start the transition process, how everybody has made it so easy that a child or a young adult can, on a whim, change their mind and start this process of transition. You want to comment about the lengthy process your daughter went through and how there are, you know, I wouldn't say checks and balances, but process steps, both psychological, emotional, social, physical, before the process is even fully engaged.
Well, I think it's really more of a gradual process, at least for my my daughter. You know, they initially don't know why things aren't right. They can't always put their finger on what isn't right. There were clues along the way, she would say, but eventually, maybe after being at college and seeing people and doing a little research, she realized that though she was male assigned sex at birth, that she felt that her gender was female. That is a very difficult thing for someone to realize and to then present to the community and family. She initially presented it to her friends at college, and what warmed us so much was how well accepted she was. It just gave her more confidence. And then when she told us, she was nervous, but we took it in and just supported her from the get-go, let her make the decisions, let her lead, really. That was one of the most important things. And we had to learn. And that process went about through her and also through, I can't say enough about the PFLAG organization. It's a national organization. We went to support groups, worked hard on learning to change pronouns. Okay, that is not an easy thing to do, as you can imagine, after knowing your child for 19 years. But she was so so good about everything. You know, if you made a mistake with a pronoun, just say, don't worry about it. You know, it's going to take some time. And it took her time to decide that she wanted to start, you know, with the social presentation, which I mentioned earlier, changing the dressing, ears getting pierced, you know, you have to have hair removal, you know, styling of your hair. There are a lot of changes, and that was over a period of a few months. And then there is quite a bit that you need to go through, you know, from a mental health therapy. And then as you deal with the gender dysphoria and anxiety that is pretty consistent with most transgender individuals, as that progresses, you move toward the hormone replacement or the hormone therapy. She happened to find an outstanding endocrinology individual that specialized in transgender probably for the last 5 or 6 years. Once that got started, she headed back to college as a transgender female and was accepted 100%, felt much better about herself. It's a very, very intense process.
Paul, you know, I don't know if your institution does transgender surgery or has it talked about how us as anesthesiologists interact with patients and what we need to do differently to help them through the process, either during transition surgery or during unrelated surgery for a transgender patient, and provide them the best care possible.
Yeah, that's a great question. I think to kind of echo what Dr. Fischler or what Adam was saying is, you know, it really is a very challenging time. And if you kind of imagine that, you know, any other patient walking through the door undergoing anesthesia or undergoing surgery for, you know, unrelated issues and just the amount of stress and anxiety and emotions that would be running through that patient's head, but now with this additional, you know, potential prejudice or psychological distress that might be associated with kind of gender dysphoria, for example, it just makes the scenario so much worse. Here at UCSF, University of California, San Francisco, we do have gender affirmation surgeries, as well as kind of, there is actually a transgender center for transgender medicine here at UCSF. And, you know, I can't speak for them, but I know kind of their reputation kind of precedes them as something, a center that really is at the forefront of both setting the standard of care, as well as kind of active research about how to provide patient-centered care for these patients. I think it's unfair to expect all providers to be comfortable or fully comprehend the what patients that are undergoing gender affirmation surgery are going through. But I think the most important message, I think, for kind of practitioners and staff and kind of healthcare members, is just to come from a place of humility and a place of kind of non-judgment, and just I think that's kind of the most important aspect of providing care.
Yeah, and curiosity in the sense of asking, like Adam said, letting the patient lead and letting them guide you. I went to an excellent talk by the DEI representative from Hospital for Special Surgery in New York. And that was one of the things that that stuck with me is, patients don't expect you to know everything, but they expect you to follow their lead. And sometimes that can be all you need to get the right information, whether it's something symbolic like a pronoun, which can be very meaningful in the moment of anxiety, or something as important as understanding, you know, biological and physical changes that may or may not have progressed yet, depending on their stage of hormone or surgical treatment that can affect anesthetic care. That inquisitiveness to ask in a respectful way, I think, is a really important part of it. And that's part of what I've learned in the process. I'm no expert at this, but part of what I've learned in the process is I'm not expected to know everything. I'm just expected to treat someone with the respect to have that conversation. Kiki, absolutely. You were going to add it. Oh, sorry. Go ahead, Paul.
Yeah. Oh yeah, no, and I the other thing I was going to add was kind of just from a healthcare system based perspective as well, kind of just creating that environment so that people can feel comfortable. So one example here is whenever we kind of take patient intake forms, for example, we kind of ask two separate questions of, you know, what is your gender identity? And always with an option to not disclose if you don't feel comfortable. And then kind of asking a separate question of, you know, what is your assigned sex at birth? You know, I think that just sets the stage already so that, hey, we as an institution understand that those are two separate concepts and we're happy to kind of discuss that separately.
Kiki, you were going to say something?
Yeah, I echo, that's kind of like the whole, you know, idea of us being able to, you know, have these conversations and open our minds, right? It's that sense of humility and that sense of, you know, just embracing, you know, that other person for who they are. You know, us as anesthesiologists, we have a very short period of time that we make a connection with a patient in a very, very stressful situation, right? You know, we did an ASA panel that was just fantastic. And one of the things that, you know, talking about, you know, transgender, you know, patients and physicians and one of the things that they mentioned was so true, right? It's going to be very difficult for us. For example, my first name is Olga. That's what my mom named me at birth, you know, but I go by Kiki. Right. So I think somebody, you know, coming up to me and saying, you know, how would you like to be addressed, and me being able to say Kiki, I mean, that just built a level of trust and a level of, you know, kind of sincerity from that person that's coming to, you know, take care of me. So one of the things that, you know, we spoke about as physicians is when you go up to the patient, you know, I know it might be a little bit hard, you know, now, to be able to say, you know, what's your pronoun, but, you know, a simple, how would you like me to address you? You know, I think that goes a very long way. You know, and kind of myself being part of the queer community, it's, you know, it's not only in surgery, but it's everything in medicine as well. You know, I'm married to my wife and we wanted to have, you know, children. And, you know, throughout that whole process, it was, you know, it was just, to be open about, you know, speaking about the different, you know, questions that a physician, you know, might routinely ask you. You know, it's that's all we want, for us to be able to have this open conversation.
I think that it strikes me that in some ways this is a challenging change that we're going through, but in some ways it's actually no different than what we've been doing. We just have to change the context. You know, for example, I was taught early on not to assume who the person at the bedside is that comes along with the patient, and to ask. And I have, when I've forgotten to make that question in the right way, I have usually ended up with my foot in my mouth and said, "Hi, is this your wife? Oh, no, that's my daughter. Okay, I apologize," you know, and it's embarrassing for me, it's embarrassing for them. And it sets us off on a bad footing of trust at the beginning of the conversation. And it's very easy to change my language, say, "Hey, who's this here that you brought with you?" And that little change in my language shows respect and an opportunity for autonomy to the patient. And then to ask the second question, "I want to go over your medical history. Is that okay if we do that?" And gives them an opportunity to let the other person leave the room and gives them that autonomy. That's something that we've been taught for years now, to increase the improve the both the privacy and the respect of that conversation. Changing our conversation about gender identity and biological sex doesn't have to be complicated if we don't make it complicated and make it part of our normal conversation. That seems to be the change that we need to get to, is that it's so routine that it's not uncomfortable for anybody in the conversation. Adam,
I was just going to say, I just wanted to add in there, Raj, is we have the capability to make this even easier with electronic records, at least at UConn Health. Every patient in the corner where their photo may or may not be, and their name is, if you highlight over that, it pops out a screen that basically says their name, their sex assigned at birth, their gender identity, and their preferred name. It's right there, and it can be delivered to each and every provider before they go in to see their patient.
Yeah, I, my extension of that question, Adam, is being a family member and part of the patient experience. Especially since we're talking about anesthesia and surgery environment, what can you share with us that where you saw really big successes, people who really understood the process and the conversation in a respectful way, and where you thought that there was some need for improvement? Like, what was your perspective looking at it from that angle?
Are you referencing, say, the preoperative period when you go to see the patient? Is that?
Yeah, anything in that part of where, you know, we as anesthesiologists could change our practices or our systems that would from a patient's perspective, make the most impact, or potentially where we have blind spots and we don't realize how we're missing an opportunity for good, respectful care.
Yeah. You know, what I'd say is certainly being a parent of a transgender daughter, I do check, you know, before I see every patient, you know, what their preferred gender or their preferred name is. And I will go in and I will introduce myself as Dr. Fischler, he, him, and I'll speak to them and say, you know, what do you, what is your preferred name? And they tell us, and I say, and the pronouns that you prefer, and they'll either tell me, you know, the he, him, she, her, or they, them. And then I'll, you know, continue with the dialogue interview. When I leave, everybody that I see, I will indicate that, you know, so-and-so prefers the pronoun he, him. You know, I'll tell the pre-op nurses to remind them. You know, when I see my nurse anesthetist or resident, I'll mention it to them, you know, in case they don't know. I think that provides the transgender patient with the feeling of, you know, comfort, safety, understanding, and that changes the whole milieu of the event. I do the same thing when we bring the patient to the recovery. I make sure the nurse understands the pronouns, you know, just everybody is on the same page, basically.
Yeah, I think the addition of those informations into our electronic medical record in a visible way, I think creates the magic of everybody knowing without the patient having to say it over and over and over and over again. Us taking the time to know that ahead of time, I think would enhance that appreciation and trust. Just like if I came in and I didn't know anything about someone's medical history versus me coming in already knowing something about them, engenders trust that and confidence that I'm prepared for taking care of this person.
Right. They need to feel safe. That's the key.
Understood. As Kiki said, we get like 60 seconds, maybe 5 minutes if we're lucky, to have somebody trust us with their life. I think it's really important to have that homework ahead of time. Let's talk a little bit about the medicine. You guys brought up a couple of issues that do come up in the medical part of taking care of patients, either in transition during that surgery or other cases. And we talked about pronouns, but what about the impact of hormones? And how that interplays with anesthesia. What are some aspects? Kiki, you want to speak to this a little bit about how you guys are teaching people about what they should be paying attention to with regard to hormone therapy?
Yeah, I think, you know, having the medical records and hopefully having the endocrinologist kind of being a part of that same system it's an important aspect. If not, we can get some of the records in our preoperative clinic. But knowing which medications, you know, they're in, how long they've been on the medications, I think that's a very key component. The same way that, you know, we are making sure that our patients, you know, that are diabetic or that are Ozempic, when was the last time they took it? I think, you know, it's a whole nother hot topic. But I think it just kind of speaks, you know, speaks to itself that that being able to know which medications are on and how long and any side effects associated with it is a very important part of our own homework.
And Paul, do you guys have policies regarding medication management, hormone therapy, and how that you have to titrate the anesthetic differently?
Yeah. So we don't have strict guidelines about what to do with the medication. We kind of defer that to the expertise of the endocrinologist. But my understanding is that for the most part, it's not recommended that patients stop any sort of hormone therapy acutely unless there's a special indication. For example, you know, patients who are on estrogen, they might be a higher thromboembolic risk. So when you compound that, for example, with patients that are on estrogens and they're smoking, and then they're going to be in this surgery, that, you know, that might, you know, teeter the risk benefit balance in one direction or the other. But for the most part, it's recommended that they continue unless the endocrinologist says otherwise. But the one thing I was actually going to kind of add in there, which I think is important, and it does come up quite often, more often than not, is the issue of pregnancy test, you know, especially patients on, I think inherently the ASA recommends that any female in their reproductive age be offered a pregnancy test. I think that's good, and that came from the data that suggests that, you know, there. You know, it's not reliable to just simply rely on patient reports of whether or not they're pregnant. And then more importantly, when those tests come back as positive, the majority of cases did result in changing of management, whether that delayed surgery or, for example. And so I think that option, you know, should be available to all patients that have a female reproductive physiology, but it should not be forced. And I think we have to be very careful to not assume that people, females, for example, females at birth, are having sex with sperm-producing partners. I think that's kind of the inherent bias there when you kind of presume that aspect. So that's just something to kind of be aware of, I think, for providers.
Yeah, I think that, I mean, I've been doing this long enough that I've had about two or three patients that tested positive on a pregnancy test as a surprise. And if I recall, all three of them, we delayed the surgery because they were elective operations until they could get counseling and seek out a plan for that unexpected positive pregnancy test. So it does happen. And it also, from my perspective, it's always seemed a little bit of an unusual testing process. It has been sort of mandated from our perspective. It's not a choice of the patient whether they want to be tested or not. And I've always been a little bit confused about our workflows on that, because are we taking a certain amount of autonomy away from them at that point? Because now, once the information is known, then now there's a new set of considerations that maybe the patient didn't want in the conversation. I don't know. I don't know the right answer to that. It's a tough one. And then there's also the secondary harm of when you're asking around somebody else, are you sexually active? Is it possible you could be pregnant? You know, is there any chance, you know, depending on who's with them, they may or may not want to answer truthfully in that situation. So it's a difficult situation, and I don't think we have proper processes for that.
Yeah, it's another interesting topic in my institution as well. We're actually changing the policy, Dr. Gupta. Like in your institution, we used to make it sort of mandatory that everybody has a pregnancy test. They could sign a declination, you know, saying that they didn't want to take it. But I'm happy to say that we've had that conversation, and, you know, including with our surgical colleagues as well as our obstetricians, about truly the risks versus the benefits of doing such. And, you know, our anesthetics, you know, that we provide that are pretty safe nowadays. So we're actually changing our policy us to give it a patient, you know, choice. So if they don't want to, they don't have to be signing any declinations or anything related to that. But, you know, obviously there's a political aspect to that as well now, right?
And in certain states, a different legal aspect too, and who has rights to make that decision and potential harm to an unborn child. It gets complicated state by state. And whether we agree or disagree with the politics or the legal aspects of it, there's boundaries upon our practice that make it complicated. Anyway, I don't think we're going to answer that question today, but it's something that each, people who are listening to this have to realize that a conversation that was probably already a little complex, does need a little bit more thought as we're moving forward into a future where we do have to consider patients' biological and phenotypical gender as different and disparate in how that affects the biological considerations of pregnancy and pregnancy testing. I want to talk a little bit about regional anesthesia because, you know, that is our society. Part of it is regional anesthesia. We do transgender surgeries at our institution. Obviously we do cosmetic plastic surgeries and we were doing those longer before we were doing the transition surgeries. It's been interesting, for the longest time, we were sort of restricted from doing nerve blocks on, breast augmentation surgery, for example, PEX blocks, because they were private pay elective surgery and that wasn't in the bundle. And initially when we started doing transition surgery for transgender patients, they were also not allowing us to do nerve blocks for those cases. But since then, that is now covered by insurance and we're doing nerve blocks for patients having top surgery. Have you guys seen a change in payers' responsiveness to regional anesthesia for these surgeries? And how is that affecting your practice?
So I do a lot of ambulatory and I do a lot of plastics, right? For either augmentation or we do some, you know, mastectomies for breast cancer patients. And, I was very, very glad to see that, in the past 5 years, it has changed, you know, to incorporate patients who are having transgender surgery because it's same type of surgery, potential same risks of having chronic pain. But it's sort of like a, you know, sort of you're used to in a mentality that, we need to kind of open up. But we've definitely seen an increase in the number of nerve blocks that we do for transgender surgery, especially for top surgery, that it's some, you know, nerve blocks that we usually very commonly do.
Yeah. Paul, are you guys routinely doing regional anesthesia for transgender surgeries?
Yeah, unfortunately, at our institution right now, it's not part of our routine kind of ambulatory kind of bundle as like it would be for kind of breast cancer and kind of mastectomies for those indications. Although that is kind of something that we're working with our surgeons with as well. I think one of the bigger challenges is kind of getting everyone on the care team to kind of agree to kind of the inclusion of regional anesthesia, how that's going to look like in terms of the OR workflow and things of that sort, than it is about, you know, the actual performance of it.
Yeah, my concern, and Adam, I'll let you speak to this in a second too, is if you want to add on this, is my concern is we're dealing with a population of patients that, as Adam already mentioned, frequently have a component of anxiety due to the psychological stress that they've been through for quite a number of years. And we know that anxiety and chronic pain and opioid dependence are often tied together. And I worry that poor management perioperatively or inadequate pain control perioperatively increases the risk of opioid dependence in this subpopulation. I don't know if anybody's looked at that, if that is evident or not, but I worry about that as one of the consequences of us tiptoeing into this change.
Yeah, Raj, you're absolutely right. To add to the high incidence of anxiety, depression is also a much higher substance use disorder frequency in the transgender community. So what you're saying is huge. I think about, we don't do very much of the transgender surgery yet. I'm hoping to bring that in at some point. When you look at preoperative management, I think it's essential to be thinking about how you're going to manage that perioperative anxiety. And in addition to the complex pain issues that can occur, many are familiar with the various types of regional anesthetics or analgesic approaches for top chest surgery, but there is not a lot of literature on the best way to manage, bottom or genital surgery. And having seen my daughter go through this, what I haven't seen addressed, at least it wasn't addressed for her, and I didn't see anything in the literature, was the consideration of using gabapentinoids, because they do quite a bit of rearrangement of tissue, severing of nerves, movement of nerves, particularly in this genital surgery. And though, the gabapentinoids are not supported that well these days in the literature for, general surgical procedures, I think the amount of nerve rearrangement with these types of surgeries does warrant consideration for using the gabapentinoids. In addition, of course, to the, acetaminophen, celecoxib, dexamethasone, that type of thing. So trying to avoid narcotics, I think, is very important in these patients. And that's why if I were to start a program with the bottom surgery, I think my top choice would be a combined spinal epidural, followed by a TEVA general anesthetic with, propofol and dexmedetomidine, that type of thing. The combination of those, you would not need any narcotics, during the entire procedure, and have a very viable post-op pain management modality that has both analgesia and sympathectomy to help with the, graft and transplanted tissue. Those are the thoughts that I have, going forward.
I agree with Adam in everything he said, especially, I think tissue trauma from surgery, regardless of what procedure is happening, is still the same. The type of, physiologic and cellular changes that it's associated at the, peripheral level, at the central level, I imagine to be very similar, regardless of the surgeries. Just food for thought, one thing I kind of was always a little curious about is if you consider it, the topic of anxiety and depression that we kind of brought up, in the setting of breast cancer, oftentimes, there's anxiety and depression that's associated with the cancer, and the surgery itself is to try to cure, but that, it's often just one piece of this bigger diagnosis. Whereas I think what's interesting is for kind of these gender affirmation surgeries, the anxiety and the psychological distress might be associated with the fact that, your gender identity is very different from your gender expression, and that the surgery is actually going to hopefully dramatically help with that anxiety and despair. So I wonder if that component of it actually differentiates perhaps the different patient populations, even though the surgical procedure itself might be the same and the type of tissue trauma might be the same. However, that cognitive and cerebral component might be slightly different. I don't know the evidence for that. I think the research out there is kind of few and far in between, just given the lack of research out there so far.
I mean, when I've spoken to our surgeons that perform the gender affirmation surgery, their basic answer is it's unpredictable and complex. Those emotions transition as from one to the other, both positive and negative in that process. And I don't think it's consistent across patients. So I think we have to be prepared for any of those responses, and prepared for both the anxiety of anticipation of the surgery, but maybe some anxiety and depression immediately after the surgery, or relief. I mean, it's, you know, I think it's difficult for us to say what that instantaneous reaction, emotional, psychological, is going to be and how that plays on pain control, because we all know that anxiety, depression, and psychological stress are magnifiers of pain expression. And so that does make that more complex, I think. I wouldn't claim to know what someone's feelings about that moment are. I think that would be different for every person and their journey that they went through.
Absolutely. And I think you bring up a good point. I think keep in mind people that are coming from both the sexual and gender minority population kind of head into the game with a higher prevalence of just chronic pain in general as well. So they're kind of almost a setup.
I think this topic is quite large. We're barely touching the surface of the conversation, but I really appreciate all of you guys introducing this to the audience who haven't maybe thought about this in their institution. I think what's really important is are some of our earlier comments about treating patients with autonomy, letting them lead. I think, Adam, that was an excellent point, letting the patient guide you in the direction that they need their help. And giving them that autonomy in this process. We should all be curious and inquisitive and strive to treat our patients with as much respect as we would treat any other patients. I hope people ask questions of their own institution about their processes and what they can do to improve the care of these patients. And eventually, I hope we don't say care of these patients. They're just any other patient that we take care of. And this is part of our normal routine, just like we would care for anybody with any medical or surgical procedure that needs to come through our path. But I do want to thank all of you guys for both your hard work on this effort to get the message out there and for being part of the podcast today. Thank you, guys.
Thank you very much.
Very good.